If you've ever studied end time events, you know, what the Bible describes as all the major events that will take place at the end time, you know, leading up to the return of Jesus Christ, you've probably noticed the fact that a lot of the narrative of the story revolves around two main individuals that the Bible pictures as very much the bad guys. And these two individuals are the beast and the false prophet. Now, if you're like me, you've probably heard the theory most of your life that the end time beast power would be a resurrection of the Roman Empire. You know, based upon this theory, you'd logically be, you know, looking for this empire to arrive out of Europe. And of course, logically, then you'd also be looking for these two main individuals, the beast and the false prophet. You'd be looking for these two individuals to come on the scene and, you know, pop up on the world scene out of Europe. Now, if you follow much of my sermons, you may be aware of the fact that about a year and a half ago, I did a sermon challenging this popular theory that the end time beast power will be a resurrection of the Roman Empire. And I demonstrated in that sermon that there's quite a number of, you know, very obvious disconnects, you know, when you look at that theory and you compare it to directly what Scripture says. In fact, there's a lot of mental gymnastics you have to engage in to try to make, you know, that theory match with exactly what Scripture says. And I made the argument in that sermon that it certainly appears to make more sense to come to the conclusion that the end time beast power will be an empire that rises out of the Middle East, and that the false religion that this empire will force upon the rest of the world will be Islam. Well, based upon this theory, then logically, we would be expecting the beast and the false prophet to be individuals that would come on the scene out of the Middle East, and they would be Islamic related. Well, interestingly enough, if we look at Islam's view of end time events and what they describe as, you know, events that will happen at the end time, you know, they have their own narrative and version of events as well. But interestingly enough, that if you compare their version of events with the biblical version, there's a lot of similarities. A lot of the same basic story plays out. However, their story basically inverts the biblical account. And what I mean by that is, in their story, you know, these two individuals, the beast and the false prophet, or at least, you know, their two individuals that they describe, are actually the good guys rather than the bad guys. And in their story, the good guys are the bad guys, and the bad guys are the good guys. It basically takes the whole biblical narrative and turns it on its head. What we're going to do today in the sermon is start a two-part series examining this particular fact. And what we're going to see is, again, not only does this strengthen the theory that the end-time beast will come out of the Middle East and be an Islamic empire, it also sheds some light on another puzzling issue that oftentimes people ponder over, I know I have many times, in studying end-time prophecy. And that is why the world is so incredibly resistant to repenting to the two witnesses' message, you know, all throughout the day of the Lord, you know, and they just keep refusing to repent, and then all the way up to the return of Christ, even when Christ returns, they're still actively wanting to fight him. Well, see, what we're going to see as we go through this, once you understand this inversion of the views, it sheds some light on why they would have this type of resistance. So as I mentioned, today what we're going to do is start a two-part series addressing these particular issues. And if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's the Islamic End Time Beast Part 1. Again, the Islamic End Time Beast Part 1. So to start off with, let's turn over to Revelation chapter 19, because Revelation 19 here tells us about these two individuals, and again makes it very, very obvious that they're obviously the bad guys in the story. It's Revelation 19, and we're going to read here verse 20. Now, just to set the context, this is in the latter part of the day of the Lord. This is literally at the point where Christ is returning to the earth. And the beast and the false prophet here have basically assembled an army of people to fight Christ, to battle him at his return. But let's just notice here in verse 20. It says, then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet, who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And these two were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. See, it makes it unquestionable here. These are definitely the bad guys. You know, they're directly battling and fighting Christ at his return, and then Christ throws them in the lake of fire. You know, it couldn't be any more clear. These are the bad guys. But as I said, as we go through this sermon, what we're going to see is, you know, from an Islamic point of view, they describe two major individuals as well, you know, that have a strikingly similar, you know, description in terms of what these individuals will do and how events will play out. But they characterize them as the good guys rather than the bad guys. But first of all, before we dig into the details of this, I'd like to again just briefly address this issue of, you know, where the end time beast is going to come from. Because as I mentioned, a lot of you hearing this are probably like myself, in that most of your life, what you've heard, you know, is a kind of a unified agreement amongst those that you listen to, you know, that the end time beast power would come out of Europe, you know, and therefore it would be a resurrection of the Roman Empire, and you should be looking in that region for these individuals to arise. Well, let's just briefly look at some of the rather obvious disconnects here of how that really doesn't fit the biblical description and some of the mental gymnastics you have to engage in to support that theory. I think if we just briefly address some of this, this may, you know, may give you some of you hearing this a more open-minded perspective and listening to the rest of what we have to address. So look over in Revelation chapter 17. This is Revelation chapter 17. We're going to start in verse 7. And you're probably familiar with the fact that Revelation 17 and Revelation 13 both speak about the beast. They both give a similar description of, you know, this beast with seven heads and ten horns, you know, and they go in and, you know, describing additional details with that. But I know particularly when you look at Church of God literature, when we discuss these two chapters, what you'll typically notice is they basically have completely different explanations for these two chapters for what the seven heads and ten horns picture. And kind of the reason for that is these are some of the mental gymnastics that you have to engage in to come up with the Roman Empire is the end time beast. And let me demonstrate why that's the case here. To start off here, in Revelation 17, in verse 7, it says, but the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you a mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has seven heads and ten horns. And then notice that description. We're going to look at Revelation 13 here in a minute. See the exact same thing, a beast with seven heads and ten horns. And verse 8. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will descend out of the bottomless pit and will go to perdition. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel, those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. And when they see the beast that was and is and what is not and yet is. And here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. These are also seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, and the other has not come yet. And when he comes, he must continue a short time. And the beast that was and is not and is himself, also the eighth, is of the seven and is going to perdition. Now, just notice there in verse 10. Now, again, we don't have to do any mental gymnastics with what I'm about to explain to you here. If we just avoid any creative mental gymnastics and we just read this the way it's written, what we have is an angel, and he's talking to the Apostle John, and the time setting is in the first century. Now, again, that's just simply what's on the page. We don't have to get creative to come up with that at all. And the angel says to John, there's these seven heads, there are seven kings, they're all seven kingdoms. Now five of them have already fallen. In other words, five of them had their time, you know, of reigning prior to this conversation. One's current, and one's in the future. Now, how would the Apostle John interpret that statement? John would understand that, okay, the one that is, well, that must be the Roman Empire that he's experiencing in his lifetime. That's how John would interpret that. It's just common sense. And John would think, okay, well, if five were prior to me, well, the one that is Rome, and there's a different one that's coming later. That's what John would come to the conclusion of. And if we just follow that, you notice here it talked about the seven, and then there was the eighth that was of the seven. That's because, you know, there were seven, and then there's a gap, and that eighth one is really just a resurrection of the seven is what it's talking about. Well, if you just look at history, what came after the Roman Empire as far as major empires in that part of the world? The Islamic Caliphate empires is what came next. And again, if you just look at a map today, you know, of the general Middle East in terms of religion, you've probably seen these maps online where they show the modern day Israel, you know, this tiny little nation that's called Israel today. And they show you that, you know, Israel is this one Jewish nation here, and everything else around it in the greater area is all Islamic nations. Now, it's all busted into to individual nations today, but it's this huge Islamic area. The reason being is because the Islamic Caliphate Empire ruled that whole area, and that's why that's all Islamic today. Now, as I mentioned, Revelation 13 is the other chapter that talks about the beast. And oftentimes, I know throughout my lifetime and what I've always experienced looking at, you know, Church of God literature and sermons that talk about it, is we come up with completely different explanations for what the seven heads and ten horns are, you know, in Revelation 17 versus Revelation 13. And the reason is you have to engage in these creative mental gymnastics to get this theory to work. And let me show you why. If we start in Revelation 13 in verse 1. It said, "Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns. And on these horns, ten crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name." Notice that description is very similar to what we just read in Revelation 17. You know, but again, notice verse 2. "Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. His feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth was like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority." Now we won't take the time to go through Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. But you know, in both those chapters, what you see is four empires that are described there. Now, if you look, you know, particularly in Daniel 7, and compare that to the description in verse 2 here, they strikingly match. So that obviously tells you when we look at these seven heads, you know, we've got to go back and include all that Daniel is talking about there in Daniel 7 in this picture. Well, if we just assume that the Bible's consistent, in Revelation 13 and Revelation 17 are talking about the same seven heads, there's just no way we can logically conclude that head number seven is going to be Rome. No, from what the angel said to John, that's got to be number six. You know, so number seven's got to be some other empire. And again, logically, if we just look at history, the Islamic Caliphate Empire, you know, is what would fit. Now, that officially ended with the fall of the Ottoman Empire. You know, that was part of kind of a string of Islamic, you know, kingdoms that went. But if you kind of lump it together, if you just Google the term Islamic Caliphate Empire, you'll see they're kind of lumped together in that sense, you know, and viewed similarly. You know, well, that officially ended in the early 1900s when the Ottoman Empire, you know, officially fell. You know, well, again, we're going to see as we continue reading here in chapter 13, you know, just like chapter 17 talked about, you know, that there were seven and then there's an eighth and it's of the seven. Well, it's going to talk about a deadly wound and then a beast that its deadly wound is healed. Well, that's, again, the Islamic Caliphate Empire officially coming to an end with the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And then in the end time, there's a resurrection of it. And notice here in verse 3, "And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. And his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. So this is talking about, you know, after the fall of the Islamic Caliphate Empire with the end of the Ottoman Empire, you know, there's a gap in time. You know, we've had about 100 years now, you know, where that's officially been out of the picture. Well, when it's revived, its deadly wound is healed. Now, as we read through the rest of the chapter here, what we're going to see is it gets into a more detailed description describing the two individuals that we started off talking about, the beast and the false prophet. It's going to give us more details about them. But understand as we go through this chapter, you have to understand what with the term the beast. There are times it's used in a couple different ways, and context kind of makes that clear as you read through. But realize the term beast can be used, you know, kind of collectively referring to, you know, all seven empires that it refers to with all seven heads of the beast. It can be used, you know, to refer specifically to one of them. And there's also times, as we just read previously in Revelation 19, where it's the term is used to refer to an individual who is the main leader of an empire. So to realize that term can be used a couple of ways, and sometimes when it's talked about, it's kind of jumps between definitions there, just to clarify. But now let's pick up through verse 4, and we'll see here verses 4 through 10 start, you know, focusing in, you know, even specifically on the individual leader, you know, referred to as the beast, you know, the individual that was referred to in Revelation 19 that Christ is throwing in the lake of fire. It's going to give us some specific details about him. And then we're going to see from verse 11, you know, down through verse 18, it's going to talk more about the false prophet and the role that he fulfills. Now, we're going to get in part two, we're going to go into much more detail of addressing the false prophet. And again, the Islamic version of that, we're going to address that more next time. This time, we're going to focus more on the individual who's the leader of the beast power. And again, what the Islamic equivalent of that is. But pick up now in verse 4. It says, so they worship the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast and who is able to make war with him? Now notice as we read through this, one of the characteristics of the beast, you know, the individual, you know, who is the main leader of the end time beast power, he's going to be worshipped by mankind. And we'll see as we put this whole puzzle together why that's important. He's going to be looked at as a Messiah figure, you know, to the world, and they are going to be worshiping him. Now, as we'll see as we read through the description here, even in this chapter, that when it talks about the false prophet, that he basically leads mankind to be worshiping, you know, that the false prophet's going to basically lead mankind to worship the beast, you know, the individual as well, not just the empire. But now pick up in verse 5. And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. Now, if you do the math there, that's 3.5 years. That correlates with the 3.5 years of the end time. It says, then he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given to him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. Now, that's the Bible's way of saying he has authority over the whole earth, you know, because every tribe, tongue, and nation, that's like everybody on the planet, this guy's going to wind up with authority that stretches over the whole world, is what we're talking about. Now, in verse 8, and all who dwell on the earth will worship him. Notice they're worshiping the individual, the leader of the beast power. Whose name was not been written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. And if anyone has an ear, let him hear. And he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity, and he who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword, and he here is the patience and the faith of the saints. Now notice as we go through verse 11 through 18, this is going to give us a description of the false prophet. Now, again, we'll dig into more detail on the latter half of this chapter here in part two. But just notice as we go through this, the false prophet is, you know, submissive. He's basically a number two person to the beast. You know, the beast is the primary leader who will be worshipped. You know, the false prophet is basically subservient to him. He's the number two guy, and he basically directs the world to worship the beast. And just notice as we read through this. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and causes the earth and those who dwell on it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And notice again, he's directing everyone to worship the first beast. And again, we're speaking about, you know, the leader of this empire. In verse 13, and he performs great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth, and by those signs which he is granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast and who was wounded by the sword and lived. And he has granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as could not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of the beast. And here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. Now, I won't go into detail in this series on the mark of the beast. There's a sermon on my website and on my YouTube channel, and there's also a study paper on my website specifically addressing that subject. So if you're wanting to study that in more detail, I would refer you there. Also, again, in terms of, you know, just the beast in general, kind of the whole greater subject, I have a study paper on my website called The Beast of Revelation. Goes through the whole subject from, you know, with all seven heads and ten horns and kind of what all that means, and covering the whole greater subject. So if you're wanting to study that, I would refer you to that as well. Now, as I mentioned from the introduction of this sermon, you know, if you look at, you know, Islamic views of the end time, because they have their own eschatology as well of how they describe major events that will take place during the end time, and they talk about two prominent individuals as well. But in their view, these individuals are the good guys rather than the bad guys. Now, the two individuals that they talk about are the Mahdi and also Jesus Christ. But keep in mind that their version of who Jesus Christ is very different than the biblical version. Now, they would claim that it's basically the same individual, you know, historically that Christians would look to, but their narrative of who Christ is completely different than the biblical view. You know, they don't view Jesus Christ as a God being, you know, who came down and lived and died for the sins of mankind. You know, they have a completely different view. In their view, he's just a prophet. But again, we'll get more into that in part two. But just understand that the two individuals we're talking about, you know, from an Islamic point of view, are the Mahdi and Jesus Christ. And again, I'm talking about the Islamic view of Jesus Christ, not the biblical view. But again, if you look at the Mahdi and, you know, some of their narrative of what the Mahdi will do, it bears a striking resemblance to what we just read here with the Bible and its in additional scriptures we're going to read later in this sermon, you know, that describe the beast and what the beast will do. And as you obviously know, as we go through this, you know, from the biblical point of view, this is the bad guy, you know, and it will describe, you know, specific events that he's going to do. But notice as we go through this, they're going to talk about the Mahdi, who they think is the good guy, but he's doing very much the same thing. The narrative and the general story are mirror images of each other. It's just turned on its head. Now, to further clarify this, I'd like to quote from a book titled The Islamic Antichrist by Joel Richardson. Now, again, if you're interested in studying this subject, I'd highly recommend this book. Now, let me also give a disclaimer here. You know, Joel is a Protestant teacher. I certainly do not endorse all of his Protestant theology, and I don't even endorse all of his prophetic views, because he has a number of views I would disagree with. But I think he does a very good job of documenting, you know, what Islamic, you know, teachings are, because, you know, he quotes through this book. He goes extensively into quoting the Quran, you know, Hadith, and other Islamic writings. So he's quoting, you know, directly from their own writings, not just, you know, opinions about it. You know, and he purposely, you know, it goes into a lot of detail quoting, you know, Islamic scholars and such. So he's getting it directly from what they themselves say that they believe. Now, a lot of what I'm going to read to you today is quotes from his book, and the sermon are going to be more his summations of things, because it's just easier to make, you know, quick sound bites to give you the overview of what they're saying. But if you want to look at this in detail, I'd highly recommend Joel's book, because he did a great job of documenting this. And then, and again, the book is entitled The Islamic Antichrist by Joel Richardson. If you're wanting to buy a hard copy, you can get it on Amazon. Or if you just want a PDF copy and you want to get it for free, you can get it off of his website, which is joelstrumpet.com. But to read with you some quotes, just kind of summarizing the Islamic view of the Mahdi. This first section I'm going to read to you comes, these are just, you know, different snippets I pulled out from pages 20 through 25 of this book. And I'll just read here from Joel. It says, quote, "The most anticipated and central sign that Muslims await is the coming of a man known as the Mahdi. In Arabic, al-Mahdi means the guided one. He is also sometimes referred to by Shia Muslims as Sahib al-Zaman or al-Mahdi al-Muntadur, which translated mean the Lord of the Age and the awaited Savior. The coming of the Mahdi is the central crowning element of all Islamic end-time narratives. According to Sheikh Mohammed Hissam Kabbani, chairman of the Islamic Supreme Council of America, the coming of the Mahdi is established doctrine for both Sunni and Shia Muslims, and indeed for all humanity. It is fair to say that the rising of the Mahdi is to the majority of Muslims what the return of Jesus is to Christians. While Christians await the return of Jesus, the Messiah, to fulfill all of God's prophetic promises to the people of God, Muslims await the appearance of the Mahdi to fulfill these purposes. Sheikh Kabbani likewise identifies the Mahdi as Islam's primary Messiah figure. Jews are waiting for the Messiah. Christians are waiting for Jesus. Muslims are waiting for both the Mahdi and Jesus." Again, their version of Jesus, not the biblical version. The Mahdi is believed to be a future Muslim world leader who will not only rule over the Islamic world, but the non-Muslim world as well. The Mahdi is said to lead a world revolution that will establish a new Islamic world order throughout the entire earth. The Mahdi's means and methods of accomplishing this world revolution will include multiple military campaigns or holy wars, jihad. While some Muslims believe that most of the non-Muslims of the world will convert to Islam peaceably during the reign of the Mahdi, most traditions picture the non-Muslim world coming to Islam as a result of conquest by the Mahdi. Now, jumping down to page 37 in Joel's book, it says, quote, "As we have seen from the Islamic traditions and Muslim scholars, the Mahdi is also prophesied to be a political and military world leader unparalleled by any other throughout world history. The Mahdi is said to fight against the forces of evil, lead a world revolution, and set up a new world order based upon justice, righteousness, and virtue. At this time, according to Islamic tradition, The Mahdi is said to preside over the entire earth as the final caliph of Islam. The Muslims will take the world administration in their hands, and Islam will be victorious over all the religions. Without question, Islam views the Mahdi as one whose rule will extend over all the earth. Now, if you notice it at the beginning of that quote, you know, Joel mentions, you know, referring to having gone through Islamic traditions and scholars and such. You know, as I mentioned, you know, through his book, he quotes, you know, has a lot of quotes and research he's done, you know, from the Quran and from other Islamic writings. So he goes to great effort to prove everything he's saying, you know, specifically from Islamic writings. So he's not just, you know, stating opinions about what they believe. He's quoting, you know, their own writings to prove what they believe. But as I mentioned, I've just, you know, for ease of communicating this in kind of a snapshot of quotes, I've chosen to quote more, you know, of just, you know, kind of Joel's summation of things, because again, it just kind of gives an easier, less time-consuming explanation of it all. But if you want to read it in detail, you can get his book and kind of go through all the finer details. But again, notice as we read through this, that their description of the Mahdi is, again, he's going to become a world leader, you know, and basically push Islam up upon the rest of the world. Now, notice that matches, you know, with, and it also described him as a Messiah figure. Now, notice that matches exactly with the general description we got out of Revelation 13. Because how is the beast described, you know, as a, you know, Messiah type figure that the world will be worshiping, and he'll have authority over every tribe, tongue, and nation. In other words, over the entire world. Notice these descriptions exactly match. It's just in the Muslim version of this, it's the good guys rather than the bad guys. But if we keep, notice as we keep going through this, there's numerous similarities, and the general gist of the story continues to match. Because the next thing we're going to notice here is that not only that the biblical account of the beast, but the Islamic account of the Mahdi, both tell us, you know, that these individuals will basically at the end time set up their headquarters in Jerusalem. And then these match exactly. And to see this, turn over to Daniel chapter 11. Again, Daniel chapter 11. Now, in a moment here, we're going to read through verses 40 through 45, which specifically address the end time, and again, tell us that the beast power is going to wind up setting up their headquarters in Jerusalem. But just to kind of give a greater context here, I mentioned it at the beginning of this sermon, you know, and throughout this, that one of the more common theories, and in fact, you know, what I've heard taught most of my life, is the idea that the end time beast power, you know, would come out of the Roman Empire. And as I've mentioned several times throughout this sermon, there's a lot of, you know, very obvious disconnects with this, and a lot of mental gymnastics that you have to engage in, you know, to basically support that particular theory. And Daniel 11 is kind of a classic example of that. Now, if you're familiar with Daniel 11, it's oftentimes referred to as the Middle Eastern prophecy, because it's a prophecy that covers, you know, multiple hundreds of years of history. Now, the beginning of the chapter starts off, you know, mentioning what you can easily interpret to be, you know, speaking of Alexander the Great, you know, and him, you know, kind of conquering the whole Middle Eastern area. Well, then he dies, and his empire, you know, busts up into multiple fragments. Well, then two of those fragments are then referred to as the King of the North and the King of the South in this chapter. And then, you know, most all of the chapter here is basically a description of, again, multiple years of history of these two empires fighting with each other. Now, what you'll find when you look into this, you know, not only in Church of God literature, but in most commentaries, it's just widely agreed upon, you know, that the King of the North is the Seleucid Kingdom and the King of the South is the Ptolemaic Kingdom. Now, if you look at a map as to where these are located, the Seleucid kingdom was in part of, you know, is basically in the area today of, you know, kind of the eastern edge of what we would call Turkey today. And then down through like Syria and then Iraq, Iran, over to Afghanistan, you know, kind of that whole area kind of across the northern edge of the Middle East. Well, the Ptolemaic kingdom, again, you can easily verify all of this on Google if you just kind of Google this and look at the maps. But the Ptolemaic kingdom is in today what we call Egypt, you know, kind of stretching down to what today is called Ethiopia. And then again, this is just widely agreed upon as to everyone as to geographically where these two kingdoms are identified. And again, this is a multiple, centuries of history of these two kingdoms fighting with each other for various reasons. Now, the reason I kind of point all of this out is what typically happens is they get to the very end of the chapter, and then we get to verse 40 and beyond, and then we insert just massive mental gymnastics because if you want the end time beast power to be the Roman Empire, well, you got to get the Roman Empire somehow in the story. And they're not in the story at all if you're talking about, you know, what the area of what was the Seleucid Kingdom, the northern, you know, sections of the Middle East, and then the southern area down Egypt, down towards Ethiopia. Well, Europe's not in this story at all, you know. So what happens though is they go through various mental gymnastics to make the king of the north beat the Roman Empire, and then oftentimes the speculation goes, well, the king of the south, well, that's oftentimes speculated to be Iran, which is right in the middle of the geographic region for where the king of the north is. So see, it just becomes this disjointed mental gymnastics to get all this to fit. Well, if you just stick with the definitions that everybody agrees upon from the beginning of the chapter and just don't do any mental gymnastics at the end of it, what you have is a story of two Middle Eastern powers that are battling with each other. And it's generally agreed upon that the, you know, the king of the north is the end time beast. I totally agree with that as well. But what that does is that places that in the northern section of the Middle East is the region you'd be looking for that to come from. But now with all that in mind, let's read through here verses 40 through 45, because you'll see that when it talks about the king of the north, you know, coming against the king of the south here, it's even going to specifically mention Egypt as one of the areas it conquers, because that Egypt was the king of the south. You know, again, if we just stick with the definitions that everyone agrees upon throughout, you know, the first half of the chapter, you know, and then we're going to see here that the king of the north sets up their headquarters in Jerusalem. And see, that's going to directly match with what we're going to see described about the Mahdi. But just to start off here in verse 40 of Daniel 11, it says, "And at the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships, and he shall enter the countries and overwhelm them and pass through. And he shall enter the glorious land." Now that's a reference obviously to Israel. "And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape from his hand. Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. And he shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. And he shall have power over the treasuries of gold and silver, and over the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels." Now notice how I mentioned before that, again, you just look at a map of where the Ptolemaic kingdom was, the, you know, the king of the south, you know, well, Egypt and Ethiopia, you know, that was the geographical region. So it totally fits to stick with the definitions established at the beginning of the chapter. In verse 44, "But news from the east and in the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury and destroy and annihilate many." Now notice in particular verse 45. "And he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. Notice he's basically planning his headquarters in this area it describes as between the seas. Well, if you look at a map of the Middle East, what you're going to see is Jerusalem sits between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea. So it totally matches the description. And to add to that, notice it says the glorious holy mountain. Well, that's referring to Mount Moriah. Now, if you look in the book of Chronicles, now I'm not going to take the time to turn back there, but where it's describing, you know, Solomon, you know, initially building the temple of God, it tells you that he built the temple on Mount Moriah. That's the glorious holy mountain. And if you also notice here, see, I'm reading from the New King James here. And it says, he shall plant the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. If you look in the regular King James there, it says in the glorious holy mountain. In other words, between the seas, basically on Mount Moriah is what we're talking about here, is where the beast is going to wind up running its headquarters. Now, you'll find that very interesting when we look here in a minute at the Islamic version of that and what they describe, because it's the exact same description. But just let's just notice one more biblical account of this. Turn over to 2 Thessalonians. This is 2 Thessalonians. And remember, as we turn to this, as we just saw, you know, the temple of God was built on Mount Moriah. So obviously a restored temple, you know, before Christ's return, we would expect to be on Mount Moriah as well. But now let's notice here in 2 Thessalonians 2 in verse 1. Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and in our gathering together to him, we ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. Now, we're talking about the beast here, again, the leader of that, you know, the end-time beast empire. In verse 4, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. In other words, he's directing the world to worship him. You know, this is exactly what we read in Revelation 13. But notice it mentions him being in the temple of God. That would be on Mount Moriah. So notice here the biblical description of the beast is he's going to wind up having his headquarters there, you know, on Mount Moriah, right in that area where the temple is. And we even have a description of him, you know, basically being in the temple, declaring himself to be worshipped. So now let's compare that with the Islamic version of events and notice that the Mahdi is described as doing something very similar, you know, that matches exactly with this description. And this is again from Joel Richardson's book, The Islamic Antichrist. And this first quote here comes from pages 26 and 27. It says, quote, Islamic tradition pictures the Mahdi as joining the army of Muslim warriors carrying black flags. The Mahdi will lead his army to Israel and reconquer it for Islam. The Muslims will slaughter Jews until very few remain, and Jerusalem will serve as the location of the Mahdi's rule over the earth. Rusala, Muhammad, said, armies carrying black flags will come from Khorasan. No power will be able to stop them, and they will finally reach Ella, Butal Magdas in Jerusalem. Well, they will erect their flags. It is important to note here the reference to Butal Magdas. In Arabic, this means the Holy House. This is referring to the Dome of the Rock Mosque located on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. In other words, it's right there on Mount Moriah as well. Now, jumping down to page 45. This is a quote addressing the same subject, just on page 45. It says, quote, the Mahdi is said to attack Jerusalem, and reconquer it for Islam in order to establish Islamic rule over the earth from Jerusalem. Armies carrying black flags will come from Khorasan, Iran. No power will be able to stop them, and they will finally reach Ella, the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, where they will erect their flags. Jerusalem will be the location of the rightly guided caliphate and the center of Islamic rule, which will be headed by Imam al-Mahdi. So you can see these descriptions are strikingly similar. It's just taking the biblical story and turning it upside down. It's basically taking the bad guys and turning them into the good guys. Well, there's another striking resemblance as well. If you'll turn over to Daniel 9 here, we're going to notice that the 70 weeks prophecy ends with telling us about a 7-year treaty that's instituted that obviously affects the area of Jerusalem. Because about maybe a year ago, I forget the exact timing now, I did a sermon addressing the 70 weeks prophecy. It was a 2-part series, and it went into that on a lot more detail than we're going to address today. But if you go through chapter 9, what you'll see is the 70 weeks prophecy is delivered to Daniel by an angel. And it's as a result of Daniel praying and inquiring about when God's going to restore Jerusalem. You know, that was the question, you know, that basically resulted in the 70 weeks prophecy being given to him as the answer to his question. Now, if you're like me, you've probably heard the theory taught a lot of your life, you know, that final week of the 70 weeks, because, you know, if you read through this, it's broken down into 7, 62, and then 1, you know, for the total of 70. But oftentimes that last week is explained as being, you know, related to the ministry of Jesus Christ. And the way the argument goes is that, you know, the first 3.5 years of that 7-year period, well, that's Christ's ministry while he's on earth, and then he dies, and that explains the reference to ending sacrifices, you know. But then there's all manner of speculation as to, okay, how do you fill in those last 3.5 years? Well, again, just because a lot of you have probably been taught that theory before, let me just kind of briefly address this. We're going to start reading in verse 26. And what I want you to notice is, to get that theory to work, Christ would have to die twice. Because it's going to tell us here that Christ dies at the end of 62 weeks. Well, you know, the 7 weeks is mentioned before the 62, and together that'd be 69. You know, well, he can't die after the 69 weeks and then die again in the middle of the 70th week. That just doesn't make any sense. So let's notice here and start reading in verse 26. It says, "And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself." Now that's a very obvious reference to Jesus Christ. You know, he's cut off. And in fact, in my New King James here, where it says to be cut off, there's a little one next to it. And in the margin, it says suffer the death penalty. You know, because that's what it's referring to. He would suffer the death penalty, but he suffers it not for himself. You know, Christ died for us to atone for our sins. That's obviously what it's what we're referring to here. But notice that's after 62 weeks. In other words, if we put it together, you know, the 7 and the 62, well, that's at the end of the 69 weeks, you know, he's going to die. He can't die again in the middle of the 70th week. Just because if we just keep reading here, notice it's going to mention more events that take place. And then in verse 27, it's going to tell us about the 7-year covenant. It can't be about Christ. But let's just keep reading here. "And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy this city and the sanctuary, and the end of it shall be with a flood. And till the end of the war, desolations are determined." And then notice verse 27. "Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abomination shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate." Now, as I mentioned, oftentimes the theory is put forward. In fact, I heard it taught most of my life. You know, the idea that the he who shall confirm a covenant, you know, mentioned at the beginning of verse 27, well, that's Christ. And the logic that's presented is, well, you know, he in the middle of the week, he makes an end to sacrificing. They think, well, okay, well, you know, Christ's sacrifice replaced the animal sacrifices, and that's how they explain the logic. Again, first of all, let's notice that requires Christ to die twice, and that just can't make any sense. But let's also read this verse from the New Revised Standard Version, because it words it a little more clearly. And then we'll understand the second half of the verse and realize there's just no way this can be referring to Christ. And this is, again, verse 27 from the New Revised Standard Version. It says, "He shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, and for half of the week he shall make sacrifice and offering cease, and in their place shall be an abomination that desolates until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator." See, it's saying he's going to make sacrifices stop, and he's going to replace the sacrifices with the abomination of desolation. That's not something Jesus Christ does. That's something the end time beast does. You know, that's one of the signs Christ mentions in the Olivet prophecy, you know, the stopping of the sacrifices and the setting off the abomination of desolation. Well, that's something done by the end time beast. Well, that tells us this 7-year treaty here, you know, this 7-year covenant, you know, because the word is, if you look up the Hebrew word, it can also mean treaty or agreement, you know, that this is, you know, something that the beast does. And again, if you look at the whole context of, you know, what this prophecy is about, you know, Daniel is praying and asking God about the restoration of Israel. You know, so obviously this, I mean, of Jerusalem specifically. Yeah, and so obviously this has got to be something that relates to Jerusalem. Well, now if we read the description of what Muslims say that the Mahdi is going to do at the end time, it involves a 7-year treaty as well. And it's a peace treaty with, you know, that's basically made with Israel. Now notice here, this is from pages 28 and 29, again from Joel Richardson's book. It says, quote, "While there is more than one tradition regarding the nature and timing of the Mahdi's ascendancy to power, one particular hadith places this event at the time of a final peace agreement between the Arabs and the Romans. Romans refers to Christians, or more generally, the West. Although this peace agreement is made with the Romans, quote unquote, it is presumably mediated through a Jew from the priestly lineage of Aaron. The peace agreement will be made for a period of 7 years. Rusala, Muhammad, said, there will be 4 peace agreements between you and the Romans, Christians. The 4th agreement will be mediated through a person who will be from the progeny of Hadrat Harun, Honorable Aaron, Moses' brother, and will be upheld for 7 years. Now, his next quote, again addressing the same subject, is from pages 46 and 47. It says, quote, "Again, similarly, the Mahdi is said to initiate Islam's 4th and final treaty between the Romans and the Muslims. Again, Romans should be interpreted as Christians or the West in general. The executioners of Nicholas Berg, in their pre-execution statement, addressed President Bush as, 'You, O dog of the Romans.'" Interestingly enough, this 4th treaty is said to be made with a descendant of Moses' brother, Aaron the priest. Such a descendant would be a Kohen. That is to say, he would be a priest. Only Kohanim among Jews can officiate the priestly duties of the temple. This is important in light of the fact that many Christian prophecy teachers and theologians have speculated that the treaty that the Antichrist will initiate with Israel will include an agreement to allow the Jews to rebuild their temple. But probably the most amazing aspect of this treaty, and the Mahdi makes with this Jew of priestly lineage, is its time frame. The specific time frame given for the treaty is exactly the same as the Antichrist peace treaty, 7 years. Now, another interesting detail of what I just read there is, you know, Joel speculated, and again, this is just opinion and speculation. The Bible does not say this, you know, but he speculated that maybe this particular seven-year treaty would be what enables, you know, the modern-day Israel to basically, you know, rebuild the, you know, the temple prior to Christ's return. Because, you know, if you're like me, that's been a subject that there's been a lot of head scratching of over many years. I know all of my life, you know, one of the things that we've puzzled over in studying this subject is you would look at all the scriptures that talk about, you know, the sacrifices before Christ returns and those sacrifices being stopped. And you look at, there are several references in the Bible to a temple existing, you know, at the end time. So you put all that together and you go, okay, well, obviously Israel has to, you know, rebuild a temple before Christ returns. But then you look at the fact that what's currently sitting on Mount Moriah today, at, you know, the site called the it's commonly referred to as the Temple Mount. Well, the Dome of the Rock sits there, and also the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And as you know, if you've watched these, you know, kind of events around that at all, there's always great controversy and conflict about things there around the whole Mount Moriah area there. So then one of the big questions comes, okay, how would Israel be able to then build a temple, you know, in that vicinity without creating a religious war taking place and without just immediately exploding into conflict? How would they be able to get all this successfully built, have the sacrifices going for a while, to then later have them stopped? You know, how would things stay peaceable long enough for them to carry this out? Well, again, this is just, obviously just opinion and speculation, but I think it makes a great deal of sense to think, well, maybe that happens as a result of this seven-year treaty. Because it's hard to imagine outside of a situation like that where, you know, Islam's primary leader made this peace treaty, you know, where the, you know, Israel could pull that off and not immediately incite a war as a result. Well, just to get back to the biblical parallels here, there's another interesting detail if you turn over to Daniel chapter 7. Because, you know, Daniel chapter 7, you know, there, you know, speaks about four different empires here. And again, if I won't go into detail about all of that. If you look at the paper I did and also the sermon that I gave about a year and a half ago entitled A Fresh Look at the End Time Beast, you know, it specifically goes into covering a whole lot more detail of why the fourth kingdoms there in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 match much better with the resurrection of the Islamic Caliphate Empire than they do with the Roman Empire. But I won't go into that at this point. But just notice here, starting in Daniel 7 in verse 23 here, it starts giving us some more details about this fourth kingdom and what this fourth kingdom will do. And notice here when we get to verse 25, it's going to talk about, you know, that what this kingdom and what this leader is going to institute is changing times and laws. And we're going to see that this, again, directly matches with the theory that this is an Islamic empire as well. Now, pick up here in Daniel 7 in verse 23. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different than all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. And the ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. And he shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue three kings. And he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. He shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. And then the saints shall be given into his hand for a times and half a time. Now, again, that's that reference to 3.5 years. You know, so we're obviously, again, talking about an end time frame here. But it mentions changing times and laws. Now, if you've kind of kept up at all with news events, you know, around kind of the Islamic, you know, migration of people, you know, particularly into Europe or into the U.S. and Canada or Australia, you know, one of the things you've probably seen come up when these, you know, types of situations are talked about is the issue of Sharia law. In other words, wherever there's an area where you get kind of an Islamic majority, you know, where there are enough people move in where you wind up with, you know, kind of the whole population of the area, the majority being Muslims. You know, this has happened in like the Dearborn, Michigan area, you know, here in the U.S. Well, whenever this happens, you also hear about controversies of them wanting to institute Sharia law in the area where they've become the majority, and that becoming a source of conflict, you know, for the others that may live in the area who are not, don't share the same viewpoints and are, you know, don't follow Islamic rules. You know, well, that's because, you know, for Islam and for Muslims, they have Sharia law, their own total set of laws, you know, that they want to live by and also force upon all the others that happen to be in their area. Well, in addition to that, they also have their own very unique calendar as well. Now, this is different than either, you know, the Gregorian calendar, you know, what most nations tend to follow today, you know, your typical January through December, you know, calendar that most nations follow and we here in the U.S. follow. You know, it's totally different from that, and it's also totally different from, you know, the biblical calendar or even the various forms of, you know, because, you know, there's lots of debate and argument about what's exactly the correct biblical calendar. But if you just look at the general structure, the Muslim calendar is completely different from those. And just to give you kind of a brief explanation for that, you know, if you look at the Gregorian calendar, you know, your typical, you know, January through December calendar, you know, it's a 12-month calendar, but it's more of a solar calendar. In other words, it's based on, you know, 365 days in a year, and then you're working in a day for leap year every 4 years. But the months are not correlated with the cycles of the moon. Whereas, you know, the Bible describes, you know, the definition of a month is new moon to new moon. Now, again, you know, the different individuals will debate exactly how you determine that. But regardless of what your view on that is, you know, you still acknowledge the fact that the definition of a month is based on the cycles of the moon, you know, and the new moon, again, starts and ends every single month. Well, you know, in the biblical version of this, it's not just 12 months in a row and then just repeat another 12 and just continue that cycle. You know, what happens is every few years, you know, approximately about every 3 years, there's a 13th month added in. Now, again, the different calendar theories will argue exactly how you determine that. But just the point I want you to understand here is by adding in that 13th month periodically, what that does is keep the months and the seasons in sync with each other. Well, that's not how the Muslim calendar works. The way the Muslim calendar works is they, you know, they go by the moon, you know, to where each month is a lunar cycle, you know, with the new moon being the start and end of each month, but they just do 12 months in a row, and then they start another 12 months in a row again. Well, what this means is you go, you know, through numerous years, and the months and the seasons don't stay in sync. You know, for example, I mean, you know, a common holiday, or you might say holy day, from in the views of Muslims, is Ramadan. You know, that's kind of their big event that they do religiously throughout the year. Well, that's on a set time on their calendar. You know, but in terms of the seasons, and, you know, compared to the Gregorian calendar, it shifts all throughout the year as the years go by. Well, that's what happens when you just put, you know, just 12 straight months and you don't add in a 13th month, and you're doing your months based upon the cycles of the moon. So it's a totally different structure. But let's notice how Muslims view this. You know, they view that following that calendar as a requirement for following Islam. And again, just to back this up, I'm going to quote from pages 48 and 49, again, of Joel Richardson's book here. It says, quote, "Now, we have already seen that the Mahdi will change the law by instituting Islamic Sharia law all over the earth. But we have not seen any evidence in Islamic apocalyptic literature of him changing the times. The simple question, however, is who else other than a Muslim would desire to change times and the laws? Beside the Gregorian calendar used by the West, there are also the Jewish, Hindu, and Muslim calendars, among others. Jews and Hindus, however, would not desire to impose their religious laws or calendars onto the rest of the world. Islam, however, has both its own laws and its own calendar, and both of which it would desire to impose onto the entire world. The Islamic calendar is based upon the career of Muhammad. It begins at the migration, Hijra, of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina. The Muslim calendar is mandatory for all Muslims to observe. Dr. Waleed Mahana articulates the Islamic position regarding the Islamic Hijra calendar. It is considered a divine command to use the Hijra calendar with 12 purely lunar months without intercalation, as evident from the Holy Quran. Not only does Islam view as a divine imperative the use of a unique religious calendar, it also has its own week. Unlike the Western rhythm of a week, Monday through Friday being the body of the work week, followed by Saturday and Sunday as the weekend, Islam holds Friday as its sacred day of prayer. This is the day that Muslims meet at the mosque to pray and to listen to a sermon. Thus it quite plausible that the biblical reference to the Antichrist who will try to change the set times and the laws describes a Muslim. As we look at the full picture, only Islam fits the bill for a system that has its own unique calendar, a week based on its own religious history, and a clear system of law that it wishes to impose on the entire earth. So you can see here, as I mentioned, if you look at the Islamic view of eschatology, basically that their view of end time events and the narrative of the story of how that will play out, it's basically very closely matches the biblical view. It just turns it on its head. And the bad guys become the good guys, and the good guys become the bad guys. And as we'll see as we go in part two of this series, we're in part two, we're going to look more at their version of the false prophet, which again is their view of Jesus Christ. And once again, we're going to see the scriptures that describe what the false prophet's going to do and what they say their version of Jesus Christ are going to do is, again, a striking mirror image. The generals, events that they play out and the actions that this individual will take, that they very much match. Again, they're just turning the bad guys into the good guys. And what we'll also see is we put all this picture completely together, as this gives us a lot of insight as to why during the description that the Revelation gives us of the day of the Lord, you keep seeing this repeated reference that in spite of all of the plagues that God's wrath brings upon mankind, and the two witnesses there telling people that they need to repent and repent of their sins and turn to the true God, they just keep repeatedly refusing to do so. And that even when Christ returns, they gather an army to fight him. The reason for that is that they're viewing all of these events flipped on its head. And they're seeing this story through the eyes that, again, the bad guys are the good guys and the good guys are the bad guys. Well, that's all we have time for today. As I mentioned, next time in part two, we're going to dig into, the Islamic view of Jesus Christ and see how that directly correlates with what the Bible describes about the false prophet. And again, we'll also again see the scriptures that describe mankind's refusal to repent at the end time. And we'll see together again a clear picture as to why that is. So we'll conclude with this for at this point and just say tune in next time for part two.